Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 41 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, it's another dispatch this week from my recent visit to BTC Prague. My guest is Niko Laamanen, a Finnish gentleman who left an unfulfilling life as a construction engineer to start a publishing house specializing in the dissemination of content promoting ideas of freedom and liberty in all its myriad forms, or in Niko's own words, stuff you don't really learn at school, but maybe you should. Consensus Network, as it is called, is a project that was born out of the emerging Bitcoin movement and has grown and evolved in a way characterized by the traits of what is known as a starfish organization. Essentially, a leaderless sort of open source network of collaborators. Those are my words, of course, more of that from Niko in our conversation, along with discussions about digital nomadism, escaping the matrix, the importance of books and content curation, as well as Niko's views on the progress of worldwide Bitcoin adoption and why he chose to move to the Portuguese island of Madeira, which has become somewhat of a Bitcoiner hotspot in recent times. Thanks to everyone for all the feedback, and please do keep it coming via the usual social network channels, of course, and don't forget to tag me if you do. You can get your tickets for our Prague get-together at libertyinourlifetime.org, as I've mentioned many times before on this podcast. This will be your best chance to meet real-life Free Cities folk all together in one place at one time, including today's guest, Niko, who will be there along with some of Consensus's authors, signing books, of course. And finally, for those of you who just came here for the exhilarating discourse, well, it's your time now. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Niko Laamanen. I think probably to begin with, can you introduce yourself, your sure. name and what you do in this world, which I already know, but like maybe let's hear it in your words.
All right. So my name is Niko Laamanen. I'm running the Bitcoin publishing house. What we aim to be is a bridge between authors, content creators, and content consumers, to create the best possible content about not only Bitcoin — Bitcoin is obviously a big part of it — but liberty, freedom, economics, Austrian economics, praxeology, stuff that you don't really learn at school, but maybe you should.
Have you got a history in publishing then?
No, I mean, apart from the company that I started, no.
So, and that's Consensus?
Yeah.
Yes. So what did you do before Consensus then? Like, how do you end up being a Bitcoin publisher?
Yeah, I'm a construction engineer by my fiat trade. I did my degrees in sustainable construction technology. I used to run these multi-million projects, renovation projects in Helsinki. Building things, ripping things apart, and basically raping the old buildings, which made me feel bad at the time already, like replacing 100-year-old wooden beams with tank-proof steel and glass. And it's just, it was a little bit disgusting already. I liked my work well enough, but I kind of burned out because, like in Finland, the more you work, the more you earn, the more they take. So once I hit like 50% taxation, I was just like, I'm working 16 hours a day, I mean, I'm giving everything. I'm not getting really anything back. So why the fuck would I do that?
And were you married to Finland? It was important to stay there and not seek out another tax jurisdiction or something? I don't know.
No, I mean, I wasn't thinking such a big picture at that time. Like, I was still kind of married to Finland, yeah, I would say. Like, I was single then at that point in my life. So it made it an easy decision for me to just like, all right, I told my boss, like, look, I can't keep doing this. I'm going to take a year off. You don't have to get me, hire me back or anything. Like, I understand, but I can't do this anymore. So he told me, like, okay, take a year off. You're welcome back when you're well rested and whatever. So I sold everything, packed everything that I owned in a backpack, 32-liter backpack.
Sold all your possessions, you mean?
Everything that I owned.
Did you have a house?
No.
No.
No, I was a renter.
Wow, but you sold all your possessions. Go on.
Everything.
Backpack, then what?
So the total weight of me and my possessions was 75 kilos, everything I owned. And that factoid, that realization when it hit me, was like, this is freedom. Like, and I'm never going to give it up again.
I've had exactly the same experience, actually. I gave up a career in Fleet Street in London in a newspaper, and I sold all my possessions. I gave a lot of them away to a charity as well, but I actually owned a house, which I managed to sell as well. And I still to this day remember the feeling of walking to the bottom of the steps that go up to the plane, and I just had a backpack. And I was flying. I had a one-way ticket to Calcutta. I ended up going to the Himalayas for like almost 2 years in the end. But I can still remember that feeling. I've never been able to capture it again. I've had versions of it because I have kids now. So you'll never have that exact feeling again. You'll never know. But you can find a version of that with children. And almost like then you kind of live vicariously through them and their version of that as well. But where did you go?
I actually took the land route from Helsinki to Kuala Lumpur. So there was no rail. I love train travel, so I mostly use trains. But there's not, like, for example, in Cambodia, there's no functional train tracks. So I had to take buses here and there and ferries here and there. But
What is that route, though? Finland to Malaysia. So go on, just off the top of your head, tell me which countries that involves.
All right, so I started with the Trans-Siberian. So I took the Trans-Siberian train, 52 bunks, open carriage with the local plebs. Of course, I didn't know any Russian and I didn't need to. After a couple of shots of vodka, I mean, everybody gets along, right? Really good experience. I highly recommend to anybody. Just to learn about life and, you know, realities. And, you know, people are not bad. Like, most people in the world, I would say, are decent. Like,
agreed.
That's something that I learned during that trip. I went to Ulan-Ude, and from there I took a bus down to Mongolia. I went to the Gobi Desert. I met some people there. Like that. And that's the thing, by the way, that I recommend to everybody: to solo travel, go alone, don't go with a friend, don't go, like, if you have family, sure, I mean, you probably can't take time off, but if you can, go alone, because then you know, you are open to all the opportunities and all the adventures.
You have to be quite selfish, don't you, sometimes?
Yeah I mean, you gotta take care of yourself
for the full experience. I know. Go on. So Mongolia, west to east, was that, did you come in the west of Mongolia, or did you come into Ulaanbaatar and then go to the Gobi?
Yeah, I came to Ulaanbaatar, and then we took like this crappy bus, the worst bus ride and the best bus ride of my life. I was literally sitting on top of the engine, like it was 24 hours and it was only 400 kilometers because there was no roads. it was pretty cool. So I stayed in the desert for like a week with this bunch of other travelers. We stayed in yurts and hiked on the dunes. Pretty amazing stuff. Like, you gotta go and see it. You wouldn't believe how beautiful it is there. And then back to Ulaanbaatar, took a train to China, went to Beijing. That's where I met my wife, by the way. At the time, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm finally alone. I'm free to do whatever I want. And then bang, Here she is.
end of travels.
But it wasn't the end. Like I continued my trip. I hung out with her for quite a while.
She was Chinese, though. She wasn't a traveler.
No.
Okay.
No. And then I went to Vietnam. That's where I got my scuba diving license when I went diving there. And then Cambodia. Cambodia is one of my all-time favorite places to be. Really relaxed, nice, cheap. And then Thailand, and then Malaysia, finally. I was going to go all the way to Singapore to meet my friend. But then my other friend got married in India and invited me. So I just flew from Kuala Lumpur to India. And then from India, I flew back to China to meet my, at that time, girlfriend. Nowadays, my wife. And I finally completed my trip a year after by flying from China to Singapore.
And then home, or?
Yeah, I mean, I stayed in China for like, I want to say four or five months teaching English to kids. Because that's like, that's the easiest, low-hanging fruit. If you go to China and you can speak English, even at a low level, you will find a job. It's not difficult.
Yeah. Was there a point on that trip where you realized you weren't going back to Finland?
No, there was a point during the trip that I realized that I have to go back to Finland because of my lifestyle choices. Like, in my fiat life, I used to live the way that I assume most people live nowadays. So, you know, borrow money to buy consumables, basically. So what I did when I quit my job and I sold everything, I paid off all my debt. So I was debt free, but I also had no money at all. So then I started accumulating credit card debt immediately when I was started traveling. Still a worth investment, by the way. So at some point, I realized that I'm not going to make enough money in China to cover that. And then I figured, yeah, I'll just go back to my old job because it pays well. And, you know, I know it's comfortable. But things has changed. Like, I was unemployable at that moment. I just didn't realize it. I thought I can go back, but it didn't work out. Like, it's there was too much friction. I have tasted the sweet taste of freedom. And I was not about to give that up anymore. So one thing to led to another. I tried it for like a couple years to reintegrate to the matrix. It was undoable.
That's a good way of putting it. I know what you mean, though. I know exactly what you mean.
And then I started my own company, consultancy for construction. So I did my construction engineering job as a consultant. That worked pretty well because that allowed me to travel with my girlfriend and then later with my kid. You know, I could with the modern technology, I could just use my smartphone on a bus in Cambodia to do some reports for a small construction company in Finland and get paid. And that was pretty awesome. Like, that was way before I knew anything about Bitcoin. I mean, I've heard about Bitcoin, and I even mined Bitcoin for a while in 2011. But you know, it just never computed to me. Like, I became a freedom maximalist way before I became a Bitcoin maximalist.
And a digital nomad, by the sounds of it, prior to all of those two.
Yeah. That was the big thing, and I would say to this day also. Then it's an even bigger revelation than Bitcoin was. Like, Bitcoin was just the final piece of the puzzle, because I realized that everything is fucked up. I realized that the life that I led, that most people live, it's not real, it's not proper, it's not free. So I became freedom maximalist, but then I ran into a brick wall, because like, how am I going to, like, I'm going to get taxed to hell, you know, everybody's got tabs on me. The money is screwed up. And there was no escape until I found Bitcoin. And then I start like, hold on a second. Like, I can have unconfiscatable money. I can keep what I earn. And it's just like, I got completely obsessed with that. And that's like, that's when I left my, I still have my construction consultancy company, but I haven't used it for 5 years, because 5 years ago I read the Bitcoin white paper, and then I just all my time went into studying Bitcoin, writing about Bitcoin, teaching about Bitcoin. And then 2018, I read the Bitcoin Standard, and I just got this idea, like, I must get this information available to people that I care about, my family, my dad, who doesn't speak English. So I wanted to translate the book to Finnish. So I started Consensus Network.
Did you translate the Bitcoin Standard into Finnish then?
I translated one chapter of that book, but most of it was done by the Finnish team. Uh-huh. So we had five people working on that team. And that was the start of the Starfish organization that I like to call it now.
Let's hear about that then. Why is your organization a Starfish organization? I've actually never heard of the term until Consensus Network. Did you invent this term?
I did not invent this term. There's a book called Starfish and Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. And I read that book shortly after I realized what Bitcoin is. And then I just put one and two together. I was like, damn, like Bitcoiners are the quintessential Starfish organization, which means that people from their own perspective organize spontaneously, like, a very, very praxeological or Austrian way of thinking, to alleviate their own uneasiness by cooperating willingly and then gathering together to bring something about. So the Finnish translation was the first instance of that. It was just first me and the editor, just the two of us, just a hobbyist project. And then once we made it public, we started talking to people about it. Then I started getting phone calls from people who are like, yeah, I've been wanting to do that. Like, can I work together? Can we work together? I was like, yeah, of course. So then we split the work, and then we did a pretty good job, I think. Cypherdian came to Finland in 2019, September, when we launched our first book, and it was a success. We sold quite a few books in Finnish. Then I started thinking, like, fringe topic, fringe language, this kind of works. If I can make it work in Finland, I should be able to make it work everywhere. So then I started expanding, and I went to the Portuguese market, I went to the Dutch market, and now we have like 10 licenses for Bitcoin Standard alone. And we have about 80 books in our bookstore, like from 2019 with one book. Now we have about 80 books.
Who taught you who to even approach in, Spain or whatever? Like, if you've never run a publishing company before or whatever, how do you go about finding what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, that's that's very interesting. I guess I possessed a certain specific skill set. Like, I'm always been good with computers, so I've always been good at researching. Like, whatever I care about, I'll teach myself to do it. And I was always good with Photoshop and all those software. So I figured, how hard can it be to publish a book? Turns out very.
Yeah, I'm sure.
but not that hard. Like, I had the specific skill set. Like, you gotta have that. And now later, after 5 years of working on it, I start to realize that this has been always my skill set, content curation. And maybe not like I'm not the best editor, I'm not the best typesetter, I'm not the best cover designer, but I can do all those things. And I can create frameworks for people that are better than me at those.
I think it's quite ironic, actually, that you've made a business out of book publishing. I mean, at this stage in history, you would imagine that was a really bad idea. Imagine.
Would you?
Well, because books are, I come from that world in a way. I've published books before. But back in the day, books were everything. You know, these days for creatives, especially, a lot of books are vanity projects. You do them as a bit of fun. There's no idea of ever making any money out of them. And especially now with the advent of Amazon online books, all this kind of stuff. I'm surprised that there's a business model to be made there. But obviously it's because you have a specialist subject. And also your readership, the readers are probably a relatively small section of society who probably value an actual piece of paper
right.
and a book, which is also ironic because we're Bitcoiners, especially, are very high tech people as well. I mean, what's your take on that? Like,
no, that's a really keen observation, and I think it's akin to the fact that Bitcoiners also they want to carve their seeds to steal. So physical things matter. Like, yes, Bitcoin is digital. I mean, it's code. It needs an internet or some kind of a data connection to other peers to function. Sure. But the same way as Bitcoin enables us to retrust each other, because Bitcoin is uncheatable. It's uncheatable money. The similar way we kind of like take a step back, like I almost feel like the technological development has kind of like regressed our minds are numbing from that. So we are kind of like yearning for something tangible. And books are tangible. They have a massive Lindy effect. And, you know, Lindy effect is when something has existed for some time, so it's perceivable that it will exist the same time that it has existed. So let's say that books have existed for a couple thousand years, maybe more. So it's perceivable that they will persist a couple thousand more years, the paper books. And of course, there's electronic books now, there's audiobooks, but they require electricity. And that's something that paper books do not require. You need a candle and you can read a book. And that's something that you cannot take away. And I feel like especially Bitcoiners appreciate that. And I think other people appreciate that as well. Like I appreciate that. I like to smell the book. I like to feel the book. It's a different experience than it's complementary experience to actual just simple content consumption. I mean, some books don't even work as an audiobook. When I go on a flight, I'm not going to haul a whole bunch of hardcover books. I'm going to bring my Kindle. It's a different service. It's a different product.
Hmm. It's funny. In my case, I used to read a lot of books prior to basically podcasts. And since podcasts, I've lost the ability to read a physical book, yet I still buy them. I have all the books, you know what I mean? And every time I see one, I get that, oh, I'm going to buy that. And I like it, I love it. But I find that listening to podcasts has fully obsoleted me reading, strangely, because I consume so much podcast. And I do it when I'm doing other things as well. I force myself sometimes to read, but it just, it's funny. My brain has been rewired, I think, in some shape or form. Yet, like I say, I still buy all the books. We've got a huge library at home because I had historically when I was younger, I created a mobile library and traveled on my own completely independently and traveled nice. Around the UK with all strange unusual books that I was getting free off publishers and stuff, but I've got all those and all the new stuff and stuff. There's probably about 4,000 books or something, you know, but yeah, I don't find it easy to read them anymore. Do you publish the digital versions of these books as well, or is it purely just like the hardcovers?
We do all versions. We're working on the audio versions. We don't have many audiobooks yet available, but we do the ebook right away after the physical publication.
And as a business, it works.
I mean, yeah, I can say that we're not profitable. Not yet. We're not we sort of operate as a non-profit, but I would say that we're just not profitable yet. I think what we're working on is establishing a baseline of library that no matter we sell a few copies here and there, it's still sort of a hobby project, even though it turned out my full-time job and business. And one day, I think everybody who's been working on the books will get paid. Maybe not huge amounts of money, But that's not the point. That was never the point. The point has always been like what I like to call is the reputational capital, which you can then cash in other ways. You do good service for people, usually that ripples into something good.
But as a business, I mean, you can live just doing that. You don't have to consult or do other stuff.
Yeah. I'm currently full-time Consensus. There's only two people who are working full-time for Consensus. There's about 50 or more people. I don't even know how many people in total are working on the translations and everything. It's sort of like a voluntary basis. This is the core of Starfish organization. So, I mean, I'm not in a position to tell anybody like, you have to do this, because I don't pay them. Anybody.
Let's go back to the Starfish thing then. Explain it. Why don't we use yours as an example? How does your Starfish organization operate then? Is it like a leaderless organization? Is that the...
Yeah, sort of. Like, there's leadership for sure. Like, I'm a leader. There's other leaders as well. Like, let's say that the Dutch team, they have a leader. The French team, they have a leader. The thing is, like, from the book that I mentioned earlier, Starfish and the Spider, the Amazon Indians had these chieftains, these Nantans, they were called. So some maybe bulky, strong, good hunters that other people choose to follow because it's in their best interest to do so. Nobody was voting for them. Nobody say like, you have to follow me. No, people chose to follow them. So leadership by example and by proof of work. And I think this resonates with Bitcoiners specifically. And like I said, you know, I don't tell people what to do. I tell people what is possible to do. And this is the framework that I've built. If you like to help, you're welcome to it. There's no money in it. Maybe not even some fame. Maybe not anything. So you have to assess your own priorities and your goals to work on one of our projects. And people just join in and pick up stuff on their own.
Take, for example, because I spoke to Knut day before yesterday on this podcast, and his new book, the Praxeology one, you published that, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So talk me through how an organization like that can work if you can't order people around. You have so Knut has the idea for a book.
Right.
He comes to you. So how do you then instruct what happens if you're relying on voluntarists?
Because people like to work on good stuff. Like a huge shout out to Mel Schilling, who is the co-editor of that book. We edited it together. People want to work on good stuff. Like it's up to them. Like I'm not, because I make it clear from the beginning, I'm not going to pay you. Like, I can't pay you, at least not up front. Like, maybe at later, once we start making profit, then sure, I want to pay everybody. But that's never the goal. Like, I try to make it as clear as possible that there's no immediate financial gain in this. So I have to be sure that you want to do this. And it's not that difficult, to be honest. Like, with good work, like Praxeology, like one of my favorite books that I recommend now in the slot of... Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, I think Praxeology is better. So having something like having your name on that and being able to work on something like that, that has immense value, but not for everybody, of course, for certain people. And those certain people happen to gravitate towards those kind of projects because they are interested in those. So it kind of like it's self-fulfilling. I don't really have to tell anybody to do anything. It's more like my role is a catalyst. Like I'm just an enabler. Like I said, I'm not the best at anything, but I can do a little. I understand enough about all the aspects of the book creation so that I can provide the framework for people to come in and thrive.
And what about, I mean, it's like open source publishing, isn't it?
Kind of.
What about the capital for the book itself? Like, you know, the cost of printing, distribution, whatever, all that kind of stuff. Is that something that the writer or the author does?
No, that's up to us. So when an author comes in-house for us, first of all, we are very grateful that they bring their work to us so that we can work on that and sell that. We do have to take some economic risk, of course, when we make the first print run. We have to, well, first of all, we put our work in, which is no cost, but except the time cost, of course, editing, typesetting, cover design, publication, distribution, all that. And then once we go into the production, when we actually have to print those books out, that's when we have to put in some capital. So it's always a bit of a risk. But yeah, we were talking about Amazon earlier. You may like or hate Amazon. I'm not a huge fan of it. I certainly don't want to be dependent on them. But they do something really well, which is global distribution and print on demand. So if you want to self-publish something, you can just log into Amazon KDP, upload your PDFs, publish it, and you're done. You can even order author copies at cost, which is a little bit more expensive than you would get, and worse quality than you would do a local print. But the upside is that you can do anything between 1 and 1,000 books. So you can do a print, like what we do is we can do a print run of 50 books. Like, it's low risk. Like, if we think that a book is not going to sell that well, let's do 50 and ship it to our warehouse where we handle the orders.
This, what you call the starfish way of organizing your business, is this something that's already existed either historically or even in a contemporary sense, or is this a kind of new idea? I mean, because I don't know, like, it's not something I've ever, I mean, you hear of things like this, but it tends to be a bunch of your mates getting together and just producing something, whereas this is a little bit more officially open source business, you know. You know what I'm trying to say?
Right. I mean, I guess there's degrees to that, but yeah, if you read the book that I mentioned, The Starfish and Spider, they give a few examples that might be surprising. Like, Amazon actually started as a starfish organization.
Hmm.
And another prominent starfish organization would be the Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hmm.
So something that people with similar ideas gather together to do better for themselves.
But why would Amazon be that? I mean, I understand with Alcoholics Anonymous because there's an ideology behind it. There's an
right.
incentive. Same with Bitcoin. But Amazon, I suppose the ideology was get books out to the people.
Well, there you go.
Right.
That's okay. Exactly what where we stand. And I can already see, I can understand why Amazon gravitated towards a spider organization. Like, it in a way, it's still a little bit of a starfish organization because it depends on individuals listing their products in their shop to sell those, right? But they do have this very, very strong spider component. And the same thing is happening to Consensus. We start to have management, we start to have middle management, which is a bittersweet and interesting thing to see unfold, like how it naturally gravitates to that.
I don't even know what middle management is. I don't work in those. I've always been a lone wolf, really. What does that even mean?
Like, let's say that we have the core team, for example, that is here in Prague, that we have the booth and everything, that is doing the management of the different teams. And then we have these different teams for every country that have their editors who are kind of like, let's say, middle management, for lack of a better word. But they are in charge of those teams. So we do have hierarchy. Like, leaderlessness does not imply no hierarchy, because hierarchy is crucial to getting something done. Like, somebody has to call the shots, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's a constant balancing act, I guess. What I try to do is remove myself as much as possible as a central point of failure, while still supporting the company as best as I can. So I guess that's the way we're moving towards.
Did you plan it this way, or did you just realize, oh my God, you know, we're working along these lines, you know? And also, did you take a photo of yourself in your garage with a Consensus sign on the wall, just in case it becomes like as big as Amazon? No, did you plan it this way?
Yes and no. I would say, like I said, I read the book after I read the Bitcoin white paper, and I put the, like, the way Consensus Network actually started was a bunch of people who wanted to make YouTube videos and educate people about Bitcoin.
Which you do put out visual content as well now.
We do. We went back to that, and like Knut is doing the Freedom Footprint show with Pseudofin, and I'm really happy with how the channel has been spun up again, because we've been focusing on books so long and not the video content. But that's how we actually originally started, just simply trying to, like-minded people getting together to educate people about Bitcoin. And what was your question again?
Did you plan it?
Right. So at that point, it was like, it was not an organization per se. Like we just did whatever we felt like doing, and we did some good stuff. And I just figured, after I read the book, I figured like, yeah, well, why not try it with this this book? Like, because, well, I was broke. I didn't have money to print 1,000 copies of Bitcoin Standard in Finnish, let alone pay a professional translator to translate it in the first place. So I figured like, yeah, let's try this model in publishing. And it turns out it works really well in publishing, specifically in publishing. Like, I mean, YouTube is basically publishing as well. It's just a different kind of content. So yeah, I did plan it, but I did not expect it to go so perfectly, like according to the plan. Like, and it never did. Like, I didn't approach anybody. Like, people approached me and they wanted to join the effort. And then gradually, I had less and less to do with everything, the day-to-day management and control. And yeah, I really liked that direction. So I would say, yeah, I kind of planned it, but I wasn't expecting it to work.
So Bitcoin Standard in Finnish was your first publication as well, was it?
Yes.
I thought Saif printed his own books. It's not true, no.
Not for Bitcoin Standard. Bitcoin Standard is published by Wiley. So I don't know the nuts and bolts of that, but apparently Saifedean used Wiley as his publisher for the first time. But the latest books, Fiat Standard and Principle of Economics, are self-published by Saif, by the Saif House. So he has his own publishing house. Mm. And he's kind enough to let us do all the translations. Like we have a good understanding on that.
So you're translating, but not then printing and publishing his books, for example. So you offer all kinds of service within that kind of, you know.
Yeah, like we've been like, once I realized that we have actually a pretty well-oiled publishing machine, and then we started offering, like last year, we started offering our services to self-publishers. And we also offer platform services. So we do list now Saifedean's English books as well, even though they are not published by us. Also other publishers' books. So why not? I mean, it benefits everybody.
Do you think the Starfish model, well, will it? Do you think it's emerging now, or do you think there's only a few real good applications of it, and you've got one of them, and you know, or is it something, you know, like some people listening to this? Is it something you would advise them to do?
Yes and no, like. This is not a silver bullet. Like, this is not going to fix your organization by trying to make it more leaderless. It has to be a very specific kind of thing, ideology driven, most likely, because you need that fuel that pushes the organization forward, and it cannot be money. So I would say most services, most businesses are best done in a spider organization. I'm never saying that the Starfish organization is a replacement. It's just a different way to organize, and it does not work for, just like Bitcoin doesn't work for everybody.
Spider being centralized authority and the legs being...
Right.
But yeah, why is Starfish decentralizing? It's still got like arms coming out, isn't it?
Yeah, the analogy is that if you cut a spider in half, it dies.
Right.
Or if you cut a leg off the spider, it's crippled for life. It won't grow a new leg. But the starfish, if you cut a leg off, the leg grows into another starfish.
Right.
If you cut it into half, you have two starfish. So it's anti-fragile.
Did I hear you correct? You think the Praxeology books, your favorite book you've published so far, did you say? One of them.
It's one of them, yeah. Definitely one of my favorites. I can't say that it's my absolute, like, I can't take sides because there's so many good authors.
What is it about that then? I'd never even heard of the word praxeology until I spoke to Knut the other day.
Well, there you go. This is something that I've been talking
about. I'm still not 100% sure I kind of realize what it is. It's a little bit like when I was first told about Austrian economics.
Right.
I was kind of thinking, by the end of it, I was like, yeah, but what is it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, in praxeology is a bit like that. When Knut explained it to me, I was like, okay, you've just explained the way people are, say, but that's just called the way people are or something, you know, so come on.
Right.
What's praxeology?
I had this exact conversation earlier today, actually. So praxeology, boiled down, is the study of human action. And that's right. It's a very broad thing.
Yes.
It's a very broad thing and very fundamental thing. And that's why I think, like, if you're going to teach kids something in school, this is what you teach: praxeology, the study of human action, how we act, how does incentive models affect our perceived marginal utility of things that we perceive. Very broad stuff, but it's very fundamental. And it shaped my whole understanding of my life, the world. Like, I would also say that the Austrian economics rabbit hole was even much deeper than the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Like, Bitcoin is just a crown jewel to top it off. The solution that emerges from the chaotic free market. But yeah, praxeology as the study of human action, and all the societies are based on human action, individual actions, individuals acting in order to remove their felt uneasiness. So everybody's a profit seeker. And the praxeology is the study of how that works.
So what was your uneasiness when you decided to create a starfish organization?
I hate the world. Like, I still do. Like,
the fiat world, you mean?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Like, I feel like I've been cheated all my life. I spent more than 30, maybe 35 years of my life trapped in some kind of a matrix that I didn't really realize what was wrong. I did know inherently, like, from within, as a freedom maximalist, I believe that we are born free, all of us. And then I couldn't pinpoint it. I just thought, I'm wrong. There's something wrong with me. And then when I found out the truth of the matter, I got really angry. Like, I'm still really angry. But instead of just banging the wall and, you know, like, crying about it, I decided to do something about it. So that's why I want to educate people. But you can't push the education. Like, you cannot wake up somebody who doesn't want to wake up. Like, they want to stay in sleep. So if you go and try to poke them, they're going to lash out and just, like, leave me alone. So what I instead decided to do is build a library. Like, it's here. It's there for you. Like, when you're ready, go have a look.
Yeah, I like the idea of libraries too. When I made my own library, I was inspired by another library, which was the library that changed my life, really. When I was in my early 20s, I went traveling. I did a number of big trips in my life, but my first big trip was about 2 years in Southeast Asia, and I met an old teacher there, he was a Buddhist teacher, but he was also very much into anything esoteric, and in fact he was Buddhist on his card, let's say, but actually he was just incredibly interesting, and have you ever heard of Theosophy?
That's the
Theosophical Society.
That's the study of God.
It's a spiritual tradition, but it is. Take me ages to explain it, I think. But basically, he was the head of the Theosophical Society in Central Java, where I ended up settling down for almost a year. But he had a phenomenal library, and the first time I went in there, I remember just pulling one book off the shelf. It was about ley lines. Do you know what ley lines are?
Ley lines are like
the fact that lots of things line up around the world,
like large
monuments. Sure. You know, and I remember I'd never heard of any of this stuff before. I'd lived a relatively sheltered life, educationally, I suppose.
Right,
and it was almost like in a film. This would have been the moment they would have slowed it down. The moment I pulled this book out, because it was like the inflection point in my life. I opened this book and I was like, ley lines, you know, and I just sat there. I ended up spending about 2 weeks just in this library. Every book was like that. There were all these photocopies of books, because out then in Central Java, you couldn't just buy books, but
right.
People used to come through and you'd literally take a book to a photocopy shop and they just photocopy the whole thing and bind it into a book and then give it back to you, and it cost like 50p or something, you know. And half the books were like this. But ever since that library, I've loved libraries, and I've ended up with thousands of books, like I say. But yeah, they are real. I know what you mean by like, here's the place you can come in if you want, and if you do, you're welcome to read and browse and understand, and you know, it's like a doorway into well, especially when it's well curated, it's a doorway into wherever you want to go.
Right.
Basically, you know. And I love that. I do love that idea. I think that's why I still buy books, even though I'm not really reading them. I really struggle to read them, I think.
There's a word for that. It's called chundoku, I believe, in Japanese. The act of stacking books and never reading them.
Really?
Yes.
What does it mean in Japanese? Literally, stacking books.
I don't know what it means literally, but the it's called chundoku, I believe. I'm probably
not
pronouncing
that?
It well.
How do you know?
By Thomas Brand is one of the translators who worked on the Finnish Bitcoin standard. I heard it from him. Like that's one of his hobbies. And then when I saw that, I was like, yeah, I do that.
Stacking hardbacks.
Yeah. Like I have a huge stack of books that I'm probably never going to have time to read.
A lot of Bitcoiners do, because if you named a book, I'd guarantee you I've got it. And I know probably I can guarantee you a number of people I know have got it, even if they haven't read it. You know what the canon of, do you know what I mean by canon? The canon of Bitcoin is very well curated, isn't it? Currently, mainly because there's not that many of them, I suppose. There are a fair number of books, but it's not like it's this broad subject, and it's moving pretty fast. And you tend, when a new meme or a new paradigm of understanding arises within Bitcoin, there's normally a book attached to it, isn't there? And I love watching this canon expand.
Right.
And I think my problem with books will always be that they're not direct enough for me. If I can listen to two people talk about something yesterday, rather than wait for 3 months for a book to be published, even though it's well curated, I think now I would rather listen to the conversation, because it's too direct. And you know, it was the same when I was a journalist. It was like, once it gets written down, it's already old. It's already old news. Do you know what I mean? But obviously, the theory is with a book, you're talking about something else. It's a curated set of ideas within the pages. But have you got any favorite books of all time, kind of thing?
Yeah, like when it comes to books, you're really looking for, like, you're not looking for like a garbage novel from a, you know, kiosk, airport kiosk. What I'm looking at books is evergreen information that will not expire, that will age like fine wine. That's a point of curating content into books. My favorite book from Bitcoin, I would mention Crypto Economics by Eric Voskuil. The reason why I mentioned that is that it's a really good, like almost perfect treatise of the axioms that make Bitcoin work, without any kind of a bias of, you know, maximalism or whatever. It's just simple facts, very practical, praxeological book. So that would be my favorite Bitcoin book that I recommend to everybody.
What about of all time? Which books do you have which are absolute, not even within this
within the Bitcoin space?
The book that changed my life the most, I would say, is probably Rothbard's Man, Economy and State. Because it just put all the pieces together, helped me understand the world, the economics. And then, of course, Bitcoin is complementary. Another book is The Starfish and the Spider, which helped me put a name to something that I've been already working all my life on, like leading from within. Those are the most influential books, I guess. Of course, I have to mention Bitcoin Standard, because without it, there wouldn't be Consensus Network, the publishing company. So let's not forget that one.
But as a book, I mean, you know, I noticed you had The Sovereign Individual on your stall. That's not that you're publishing it.
No.
No, you just put it on there.
Because it's a good book.
Yeah.
And I don't know when is this going to be out, but maybe I can mention that we actually have the German license for The Sovereign Individual. So we're going to do the German version.
How many versions of it are there then? Is it just in English at the moment?
There's plenty. There's plenty. I think it's available in Spanish, I believe. I'm not sure about the other languages, but I was surprised to find that there's no German version. So
yeah,
we're
going
to do that.
I would have thought that would have been one of the first. Mm-hmm. Talk about places around the world here. Is it right you live in Madeira?
Yeah, okay. That's right.
I thought so. We'll come to that in a minute. Where have you based your company then? Or is it, I mean, I know it's a starfish organization, but have you used Madeira as a place to incorporate yourself or whatever? You know, is that something you even thought about? Or
I have a local company that I'm not currently using, but I'm looking to maybe open some kind of like a local consultancy and stuff, just because I live there. Seems to make sense. But Consensus Network was always an internet company. Yeah. So I incorporated in Estonia originally, because they have the e-residency thing, which makes it really easy to manage from anywhere. And at that time, I was traveling a lot, digital nomad life. And now maybe a little bit more settled down in Madeira, but it doesn't really make sense to move the company around. It's still in Estonia. We've never had an office in Estonia or anything like that. We have an address there, and it's corporate there, but it's an internet company from the heart. Hmm. Like, sure, we have suppliers in meat-based locations, but all the things happen online.
How do you end up in Madeira then? What's the Madeira connection?
Yeah, that's interesting. Madeira was never on my map. I have this friend who used to live there. He doesn't anymore. And he really talked Madeira up to me. It's like, dude, you have to come here. And, you know, it's great. And it's summer all the time.
Why go to Madeira?
Well, I'm from Finland. So
everywhere's good.
It doesn't take a lot. I mean, Finland is great for like 1 or 2 months a year in the midsummer, when you go to the mökki by the lake and you take a sauna and you take a dip in the lake, and it's great. It's fantastic. It's the best place to be. And then the rest of the year, the 11 months is crap. So in Madeira is sort of like the midsummer of Finland all year round. So that was pretty much all it took for me. And all the Bitcoin stuff that is happening now is just gravy. Like, that's not why I got there. That's not... Like,
before all that, I mean, we'll go into this, but you originally moved there before any of the connection with Bitcoin,
yeah,
potentially. Right, okay.
I hadn't met Andre or anybody else, just my friend who lived there. And he was moving out, so I took his apartment. I'm still staying in that apartment. And the only reason why I got there was the weather, to be completely honest. And also because it's a nice place for family, it's pretty safe, lots to do. And the prices are much more decent than in Finland. Like, you can get like a 30% upgrade on your lifestyle just by moving there. I mean, it's just, there was no reason at all to stay in Finland.
Are there any tax or jurisdictional reasons to live in Madeira, for example?
At that time, yes. Now, nowadays, I think things are changing. Maybe still more, preferable to Finland, for example. Like in Finland, the Bitcoin taxation is terrible. At that time, when I moved, it did factor a little bit into that there was a Bitcoin tax of zero at the time. But now they change, they're changing it to, I think, like 20, 21, 22%.
On a transaction?
On a transaction, unless you held more than a year. So it's similar to Germany, I believe. It's still better than Finland, but that was never really, you know, that was not the deal maker for me. It was just the weather and the more comfortable life.
And were you part of the orange pilling of the... is it prime minister or president?
President. Yeah, there's a president on Madeira.
Were you part of that whole thing?
I was.
Can you tell me about that then? Like, right from the beginning, you know, how did it start? How did it go? And how is it going? Let's say, or what's the, maybe describe? Is it free Madeira? No, it's not free Madeira, is it? What's it called?
It's free Madeira.
Oh, it is free Madeira.
Yeah,
it is free Madeira. Why is it free Madeira then?
It's an acronym of some words that I can't remember right now in Portuguese, of course. But yeah, the idea basically is to work sort of like a filter. Like, there's no escaping the fact that somebody is going to be talking about the governments, about crypto or, you know, all kinds of things. So it's better be somebody who knows what they're talking about. So I think that's the main reason. The way I got involved was after I met Andre.
Who started it?
Who started it, yes. And Andre is a serial, he has many businesses. He's an entrepreneur on the island, been there all his life. And he has like five or six businesses, I don't even know. I don't know if you talked to him, but...
Yeah, I know. I met him a number of times.
Right. So Andre got this crazy idea that the president actually came to visit him for another, like, not Bitcoin related business, and he saw the Bitcoin sticker on his wall in the office, and they got talking, and then one thing led to another, and then suddenly he's taking the president to. Miami.
The Miami Bitcoin Conference.
Right. Yes. So that escalated really quickly. Like, I moved to Madeira 2 years ago in June, and this all started going down like a couple months after. Like, I met with Andre, and then like 2 weeks later, he's telling me about all this stuff. Like, yeah, I met the president. I'm going to orange pill him and I take him to Miami. It's like, whoa, like, okay.
But when did the contingent of Bitcoiners go to Madeira? Was that before or after that?
I think Bitcoiners have been interested in Portugal in general because of the 0% crypto tax that used to be. And Madeira, of course, is a paradise island. So the same reason I went there. Maybe not Bitcoin specific, but definitely after the orange pill of the president and going to Miami and making things a little bit more public and official. And of course, then there was this whole collective of a lot of good Bitcoin thinkers and influencers that came to the island to talk to the regulators.
Peter, our CEO from the Free Cities Foundation, he was part of it.
He was there, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You were there?
I was there as well. Great group of people, and we spent a week together going from office to office, talking to people of influence on the island about the possibilities of, you know, Bitcoin mining, everything. So I think we got the message through, but of course things are moving slow in the fiat land, so people get excited about stuff, but then the reality hits and we're still in the EU, and it's not that autonomous after all. Like, there's limited things that we can do there. But I will say this, that my experience from all those meetings is that they are extremely interested, and it's just a matter of getting the correct information to the correct people at the correct times.
What's your sense of Madeira in general and autonomy? Are there people, because it's kind of like an island, are there people there looking for autonomy, or are they happy that they're part of Portugal?
Well, I mean, I I don't want to offend any Portuguese people, but my understanding is that the Madeiran people are quite proud of their island, and they necessarily don't want, like, they kind of have a history with the mainland to do things differently, and I guess that's behind the whole autonomy and having their own president and stuff. So I think there's some kind of a sense of separation in a way. I don't know. It's still part of the EU though, so I don't see any kind of like secession happening realistically anytime soon. But then again, it's an island, so if something lifts off of a country, well, that will be it.
And was it easy for you to go and live there?
Very easy for somebody who holds a EU passport.
You can just go there.
You can just go there. You need a lease for at least 1 year. If you get the NHR, which is the non-habitual residence permit, took about 2 months to set everything up. Of course, running from office to office, as you do in the fiat world. Nothing too crazy though. Just follow the protocol and show them the correct bank statements, and you know that you're so-called a high net worth individual, somebody who has a high profession, which includes almost every remote worker. To be honest, like it's not that difficult to get a residence permit.
Are they actively pursuing? Or is it just something? I mean, you hear about it in Spain recently and Portugal, you know, with their crypto laws and et cetera, et cetera, that a lot of governments have seen an opportunity in the digital nomad life, or the people that aren't really site specific who can move around. Is Madeira actively, I mean, do they get that they could be somewhere that, for example, Bitcoiners would like to go? Do they understand that aspect of it? In the same way that El Salvador made a very shrewd move by adopting Bitcoin, not least for the fact that they now have a hard money in their country, but that they increased the number of foreigners who are going there in sensationally. You know, and I've seen it with my own eyes, that move in itself, which is pretty much a Bitcoin move. All right, now, because it's a safer country, there's a lot of other people going. But the attraction in the beginning was Bitcoiners wanting to go and spend Bitcoin, for example, and just live amongst Bitcoiners. Is Madeira like that?
Yeah, it's very much like that. The only difference I would say is that, you know, in El Salvador, they can do things because it's a sovereign nation. Not so with Madeira, like it's EU still. It's part of Portugal that is part of EU. So there's the hierarchy that you can't simply bypass. Like I said, the people we talk to in the management, they are very interested. And of course, they are very interested in luring high net worth individuals, Bitcoiners, to come to the island and make investments and start businesses. So I guess we kind of just trying to grease the wheels a little bit, make it a little bit easier. Merchant adoption is, of course, a big thing, and educating the locals.
How's merchant adoption going?
It's not going terribly. Like I think there's like maybe four places on btcmap.org now on Madeira, officially, that where you can pay with Bitcoin. One of them is Chao Pizzeria that I orange peeled during the pizza day last month. So I think the important thing that I see within the 2 years that I've stayed there is that more Bitcoiners are coming in. Like that's the number one step.
To live or on
to home. Live.
Is that right?
Right. So many people, like I feel like I meet Bitcoiners almost every week. New Bitcoiners who come to the island to scout.
I've got to ask you about that, because what I'm noticing with Bitcoin adoption is you get these little flash points, like you've got El Salvador, then you've got Lugano, then you've got Madeira. And I do wonder whether there's much longevity in some of those things if the fire isn't tended to afterwards. And I wondered that about Madeira, because Madeira, when it happened, was huge news. It was, you know, it was a big announcement at the Bitcoin conference and blah, 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 and blah, 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 you know. But you're saying that Bitcoiners are still coming. So the meme is still strong.
Like. I mean, look, like let's go back to kind of like Starfish organization, and Bitcoiners are the quintessential Starfish organization. So Bitcoiners do what is best for them. They understand that they are sovereign individuals, and they are looking, you know, their regulation shopping, jurisdictional arbitrars. We understand those things. And we choose to come to Madeira, a lot of us. And they come, I think, for the same reason that I originally came. It had nothing to do with Bitcoin. It's not because that, oh, I can pay for my pizza with Bitcoin. No, I don't care about it. I understand that that's not realism. Like, maybe if we go to El Salvador, you can pay McDonald's with Lightning because they force that on the entrepreneurs. That's not real adoption. That's coercion. So real adoption happens when real people go to a place and start doing work. And what I see is Bitcoiners coming to the island, starting their lives, bringing their families. That's the true adoption. Like, it will take time. It won't. It's not going to be like Bitcoin Island. And no, it's some people like to brand it that way. Sure, I understand it. But I have a more realistic view of it. I came to the island because I like the island. I like the weather. Simple as that.
What do you think about all those places then? Bitcoin Island, Bitcoin Lake, Bitcoin Beach, Bitcoin this. Do you think there's longevity there? Or do you think the adoption process will arise in places where, like you say, people won't use Bitcoin as their primary reason for going somewhere? Although arguably they would if... But you'd have to be a pretty hardcore Bitcoiner. If you've got all your net worth in Bitcoin, then it makes sense. But what do you think of the little places that are springing up everywhere now?
I mean, yeah, I think those are kind of like fads. A lot of people like El Salvador, what they're doing. I'm a little bit wary because of the coercion aspect. Like, once you make something legal tender, that implies... threat of violence unless you do what we tell you to do. So that's not real adoption. You can't put a gun to a man's head and say that you have to accept Bitcoin. I mean, you can, and they have, but that's not real adoption. It's not gonna live long, I think, because people, like I said, people want to be free. People want to make their own decisions. They want to make their own choices. And of course, you can argue that it's better than a fiat standard. Can't argue with that. I mean, it's true, but it's still coercion. So to answer your question, do I see longevity? No, I think it's a short road to ride the kind of like Bitcoin choo-choo train and like every like HODL and never sailing and laser eyes and just everything's going to be great. Bitcoin's going to fix everything. But everything is still dependent on human action, voluntary human action and human trade. And I mean, you can't force that on people. And sure, you can have great Bitcoin parties. You can have Bitcoin gatherings. Those are all great, like the conference in Prague. You know, it's really fantastic. It's great to be with your peers. But let's be real, that's not most people in the world.
I hear what you say. I'm just thinking on the other side of that argument that maybe I agree that obviously forcing people to use Bitcoin is not necessarily the right way to do it. However, no one's forcing the average person in El Salvador to use Bitcoin. Like, most people, a majority of people aren't using it. But I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time there since the Bitcoin laws passed, and people have been using it because it's there, and then I'm starting to understand it. That has been an experience of mine. In particular, somebody receiving Bitcoin to a Strike wallet, for example, and getting a US dollar stablecoin, and then, you know, using it like that, which would never have happened without the Bitcoin law.
Right.
And I can only predict, because this has happened to someone on Orange Pill near where I live, who now stacks Bitcoin, but who originally got into it as a payment, for receiving payments. I see that that is one adoption model. The adoption model being here's a way to receive money that's different for you, or here's a marketplace. Like in the case of my friend back in Wales, she's a meat producer who wanted to sell direct to customers but couldn't. And I said, look, I know a market for you. All you have to do is receive Bitcoin. So she went, yes. I said, you don't even need to receive actual Bitcoin. You can receive pounds if you want. And I actually think that's better for her, because in the beginning, she didn't really know what was going on. But it was within about 4 weeks that she asked me how she can now stack a little bit of Bitcoin on the side. I don't need it all. I want to stack some. And I think that's part of the adoption of Bitcoin. That's been my experience. And in fact, most Bitcoiners go through that even with stacking. You know, I chuck $10 in, chuck $20 in, $50, $100, $20,000. Right. You know, it's like once you get it, you get it. But you need a reason to start thinking about it.
Right.
And there's no better way than someone actually transferring value to you. Right. Really, really. Like, so in El Salvador, our local pupusa lady, I used to pay her with Strike. You know, I used to pay to her Strike. And, you know, it doesn't matter that she's not receiving Bitcoin. She's receiving a dollar stablecoin. I'm sending her Bitcoin, but down the Lightning Network, she's getting, because one day there'll be a bull run in the next bull run, and she'll look back at her Strike wallet and go, oh my God, those extra sats I forgot to convert, they're worth so much more. And, right. And, you know, which is the adoption process. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah. You can't deny that, like, if you make something mandatory and then people start doing because they don't want to go to jail. Like, sure, customers don't have to use legal tender. They can choose dollar or the local currency. But the merchants do have to accept it. That's the definition of legal tender. So, I mean, there's no denying that once you force people to do that, they might get around it. It's like, hey, this is actually good. Hmm. But they did not choose it. Like, they might come around because of it, but that doesn't make it right. Still better than just forcing them to use US dollars, I suppose. I mean,
which
you can make that
same
case.
Thing, yeah.
which is the same thing. And that's not what the, that's not about the, like, that's not freedom. Hmm. That's not true freedom. That's not true adoption. Like, it may lead to adoption, sure. But, like, let me give you an example. Like, this guy, the owner of Ciao Pizzeria in Funchal, an Italian guy, really nice, Ricky. I went there just with my family to eat because I like pizza. Mm-hmm. And he makes real Italian pizza, and it's really good. So I like the guy. I see he's a proof of work guy. He's working there all day, every day, making the pizzas himself. So I talked to him because the pizza day is coming, the Bitcoin pizza day. So I figured, like, yeah, let's do it. And somebody from the Telegram group told me that, like, Ciao Pizzeria has the best pizza. That's why I went there in the first place. So I went to Ricky. I said, like, hey, I really like your pizza. I got 20 people. I didn't have 20 people at that time. I told him I have 20 people coming on Monday for a party here. Can you accommodate? Yeah. So he was so happy to get more business. And then we shook hands, and I told him, the last thing I told him was like, oh, by the way, we're all Bitcoiners, so it would be great if you could accept Bitcoin. That we would really appreciate it, and we will bring you more business. And it's like, oh, I don't know anything about Bitcoin. It's like, no problem, I'll teach you. Do you want to learn? I'll be here tomorrow. What time is good for you? So I went there at the time when it was good for him, and helped him install a mobile wallet, and now he accepts Bitcoin.
Which was my exact experience with the farmer that, you know, I knew the kind of human capital of the Bitcoin community was hugely valuable, which is interesting. It's like, it is a very, Bitcoiners will step up if they see an opportunity to do a good thing, which this is. And like you say, you came at it from the position of, here's some business for you, you know.
Right.
But the caveat is, of course, you know, to you should accept Bitcoin because we all really believe in this stuff as well, you know. And it does allude to the very hugely important, huge importance of the human capital there, not just the fact that Bitcoin's peer-to-peer censorship resistant money. It's right. The fact that there's a bunch of real life people who really care about it, which I suppose goes back to your starfish analogy again, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The starfish thing works because it's not just ideology though, it's good people, right? Am I right there? It's good people that really want to help and really want to do good and do the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin wouldn't function without the people. Like people are the things, the cogs that make the machine go. The only way Bitcoin can function is because it's able to pay for the people to work for it. So that's the quintessential starfish organization. There's no leader, there's no, it's just pure incentives. Like there's no pure way of having an organization that is leaderless.
Do you get Bitcoin. Starfish organizations that are doing, having negative impacts? You know, like kind of criminal. Can you have a criminal starfish organization?
Yeah, of course. Like it's just human action. Like if you have a bunch of like I suppose gangs are really close to what the.
But they have the quintessential leadership roles, though, don't they? Really.
Yeah, but I think that's akin to the Nantans of the Amazon Indians. So that you, yeah, I mean, maybe there's some violent threats and stuff like that. Like, if you don't follow me and if you don't do this, I'm going to blow your brains out kind of stuff. That's possible. But it's also possible that somebody's just really good at their, criminal activities. So then the smaller criminals will choose to follow them because some of that fortune will spill off on them. So, yeah, of course. I mean, there's no... good or bad in starfish organization, I guess.
Last question. Future of Madeira. What would you put your money on as a place and connected with Bitcoin technology, your life, your business? You know, are you in there for the long term?
Yeah, I think so. What I like to say is that Madeira is probably the least worst place in EU. To stay right now.
Well, that's a high accolade. Well, that is a high accolade because the EU is a bit of a shit show.
It is.
If you're someone like we are. I think a lot of people quite like the EU. I'm sure they do. But yeah. From our perspective, it's a complete shit show.
But the thing is, like, of course, I got the bad side of the isolation because my flight was cancelled for BTC Prague and I had to miss the first day, which sucked because it was an island. It was a tropical storm. Sure, there's caveats, but also the isolation for someone like me who wants to just be left alone. Madeira is great. I mean, there's only a limited amount of people that can ever be there. There's only about 200,000 people there. Funchal, of course, is the majority of it, but there's also like this beautiful countryside, smaller villages all around the island. And 80% or 85% of the island is protected. So you cannot even overcrowd it. So I think that's a plus for me. Like I like to curate things and I also like to curate my company. Not just my business, but my the company that I keep. So I don't have time for useless friends or people who waste my time. And I think in that sense, Madeira is a good place because what I see is high signal individuals arriving, which makes me really happy because when I want, I can have those high level conversations with the people that I choose, which I couldn't do before, not in Finland or not anywhere really. So I think Madeira is a good place. That being said, I always keep my options open. Like if the shit hits the fan and the EU... goes haywire, which it might, which it probably will, then I'm going to have to look for other options. But for now, sure.
Well, thanks, Nico, for talking. I'm glad to hear that there's a a filter on the way into Madeira. That sounds like it's attracting pretty good human capital. I quite like the idea of at least going there on holiday. Unfortunately, I can't relocate. I'm at the wrong stage of my life. It would take a proper reason for me to relocate. But I watch closely when the Madeira crowd post their photos on Twitter, and it does look quite an astonishing place. Beautiful.
When you go to Madeira, things tend to happen to you. Like, I've seen it happen. I've seen the light go on people's eyes when they arrive. They're like, yeah, I want to live here.
Really?
I've seen that many times. I haven't seen that anywhere else.
And how do you get there, just out of interest? Like, what, direct flights from most big cities, or?
Yeah. Or some cities you probably want to, you have to fly to Lisbon first and then from there. But yeah, there's direct flights even from Finland. Like, I think you can fly directly to from most big European cities, I believe.
Well, I will put that one on my list of amongst the 20,000 other places.
I always like to say, like, the worst thing that can happen is that you're going to have a wonderful 2-week vacation.
Yes.
You should at least come for 2 weeks. Like, it took me 2 weeks to fall in love with Madeira. And that seems to be my experience with other people as well.
Well, congratulations on your romance with Madeira. Sounds cool. And thanks for coming to talk to us. I appreciate hearing what you've got to say. And yeah, good luck.
Thanks a lot, Tim.